Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is Ina Berkey. Today's session number is BEI 2001-6, and this is the second presentation of the Church Year's Christmas Cycle. Let's listen in.
If you have a green and a blue book as you come in, you'll probably need them. So then we have to sort of be prepared to begin a certain way. And that sounds like this. My name is Ina Berkey. If you were here with me yesterday, it's really nice to see you back again. If this is a day that you could come for the one and only time, I'm thrilled that you're here. I serve a parish back in Washington, D.C. and Springfield, Virginia, as the organist, cantor, and various other things, quote, as may be assigned by the pastor, unquote. So with you, my heart is very distressed today, and I'm going to address that with a hymn that for me is great strength, but I'll do that at the end. This is session two of a continuing series, but each session is separate. Yesterday, we took a whirlwind tour through the church year using hymns to illustrate each of those segments. Today, we're going to dwell in depth at Christmas. And first of all, we'd have to go back and say for a moment that the whole idea of the church year is one way that the church gives rhythm to our church year. I suggested that 10 days ago now, last Sunday night when we were here, the moon was full. And by Tuesday night, it wasn't full, and it won't be full again, but we know that in a very regular cycle, it will be full. And it comes just as sure as the sun comes up every morning, the moon is full on its regular cycle. We said that lots of things in the world deal on a cycle, even our bodies. And if you've just been in the session with Cliff, you know exactly what we're talking about. We even have a name for it. We call it biorhythms. And we were suggesting yesterday that our bodies work best if we can somehow allow our body to stick with that rhythm. I told you yesterday that my biorhythm certainly suggests that I would enjoy more sleep than I get. And that this is probably the only place I ever get that, where I can just go to sleep and say, okay, body, no alarm clock today. When you wake up, we'll go to breakfast. And the body really does have a regular way that it works best. Now, the church year didn't start because Jesus said, you will have a church year. It's something that developed over time. And we suggested yesterday that the early church gathered for two things that we know from its very earliest time. The church always gathered, the community, the way, always gathered once a week on what they call Sunday, and they gathered together around word and around the meal. This went on from the very earliest times. And the other one thing that they always gathered for from the very earliest time, and here we're talking earliest time after Jesus, would be once a year for the great Pascha celebrations, which came out of the Passover, which comes with roots as far back as we can remember to Abraham, Isaac, and the great ancestors. There, they gathered together to celebrate the season, Passover then, which then became their Easter. So once a year, it was this huge festival that really extended up for 50 days, and it had other names that went to it as we went along. But in the earliest time, it was called the Pascha. Paschal candle, the Paschal lamb, all those other words that come from Pasch, that word from the ancient times. And we said that it then very quickly expanded to be a 50-day celebration, and much later in time then it had a name on the other end of that 50 days that we'll talk about too. Advent, Christmas, Epiphany, they all focus on a cycle of God's great gift to us, God sending God's Son. You remember we've heard earlier in the Bible study today the great faithfulness of God and a God who understands even on this day, the 11th day of September, what pain and suffering and sorrow is about. And it all began at that Christmas time when Christ was sent as the, we call it the incarnation, God manifest among us. And so from the early time, we talk about Christmas, and I think we'll start right in the middle of this time. In the Eastern Church, it was very easy from the early time, and it really often centered around January the 6th. Now, if you want the mathematical formulas for this, I'd have to think about how we can say that they probably thought that they were celebrating the conception of Jesus and looking ahead to when Jesus was born. So that would come out around January 6th. So the church then often would celebrate Epiphany, the next earliest event that we know about in the church. Christmas didn't come till much later. But right after that Pasch, that Easter event, the church early on celebrated Epiphany. Epiphany came to us for even those first 3 centuries is the next most important thing that the church celebrated. From early on, it was about the idea that from as far away as the person could think in those days, the Gentiles, the people who didn't know about Jesus, came from far away. The idea of making manifest around the world that, as they knew it in those times, the good news of Jesus coming as a baby. Well, what are some of the songs that we sing at Christmas? And we'll start with Christmas time. You remember we were going to talk today, and I said I'd have a prize for those if you could come up with this idea. And you will answer the question right off. What Christmas carol is written with the music celebrating the 400th anniversary of the printing press? Did anybody come up with what that was? Well, then we have to go back to that little formula, just in case this is your only day here. Remember we said we can always look in the bottom of a hymn, that we have a number here and we have a name here. But down here is important information, that you can look and see who wrote the text. You can look and see who wrote the tune. On this side, you'll have a tune name. And you'll have all those funny numbers that we talked about and did some examples. I'll give you some more examples today of some interesting ways to spot hymn tunes. Anybody hazard a guess as to a Christmas carol that had to do with the printing press? Well, I'll have to ask another question later, won't I? So, your green book, let's look at your Christmas carol number 60. Now, if you look in the bottom over here, the first thing you'll note that the text was written by Charles Wesley. If you look at that wonderful, one of the places in the back of the book, you'll see that Charles Wesley and his brother wrote many, many hymns. They were prolific hymn writers in the early 1700s. Now, it was a little later that someone put that together. It was always sung with this tune. But as late as the 1800s then, when the hymn tune, Mendelssohn, was written, guess who? Now here we have the name of the tune being called Mendelssohn, so what do you suppose that probably means? That Mendelssohn wrote the hymn tune. Now here's how it comes out. Think about a piece of music that Mendelssohn wrote to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the printing press. He wrote it for a men's chorus and a great group of instrumentalists, and it sounded like this. Now think about Gutenberg, and the men's chorus would sing Gutenberg, and the instruments came in. Gutenberg. I promise this is true. I can show you the whole thing. But enough to say that that is the way this came. And from the early time, Mendelssohn really tried to say to people, I don't think this is a good tune for this text. But over time, people still enjoyed singing it that way, and that's how it comes to us today. We've said yesterday that many tunes come to us out of a different beginning. It's only, we'll have examples today of a composer who sat down and wrote a wonderful poem and sat down and wrote the music to go with it. But most often, a poem writer would appropriate a tune from someplace else, or very often, as in that early Christmas song we'll talk about later, of the Father's Love Begotten. That text came to us from the year 300 and didn't get put with music till probably into the 1800s. And we'll play with that as we go along. So here, a hymn tune that was written for a very commercial, secular kind of event, the 400th anniversary of the printing press. But it worked very well for it to be set with this kind of music. Now, you will probably forget that, and that really won't make any difference to you as you sing Christmas carols in the future. What are some of your other favorites? How about Joy to the World? If you look at 39, we can talk about that. And here again, there are interesting ideas about Joy to the World that you may not have thought about. This book has certainly been well used. Hymn 39. Look down to the bottom again, and who is the hymn text writer for this?
Isaac Watts.
And if you look in one of the indexes in the back, you'll see Isaac Watts with a myriad of hymns attributed to him, another one of our very prolific hymn writers. Now here we see tune, and the tune here says something about Handel. Do you remember yesterday we said that in the Advent music, Comfort Ye My People, that it uses that text? And then the beautiful words, Comfort Ye My People. That's what Handel did with it. We saw in hymn 29 that the text writer took that and put it to a different tune that we sing with the same words. Now, how does that work for this? Let me point out a couple of ways that Handel used this very same piece of music in his Messiah, but then you have it coming again. Now, we sing. Any familiarity for you from that glorious chorus from Handel called Glory to God that goes. And here's Joy to the Lord. Now, that's, as I suggested yesterday, it's probably hard to be totally original. We're all filled with a mind that has everything that we've ever heard, and to sit down and say, I'm going to do a piece of music that goes with this text that nobody's ever heard before. Maybe so, and maybe not, and if there's already good music for it, why be original? Then he gets down to the second part, and he must have been thinking again about something else in Messiah, because we have this. Now, think about Messiah again, and where do you hear this?
Hallelujah, Christ.
He does this marvelous tune writing that he's used both in his Messiah, and then Isaac Watts, the great hymn writer, picks that up to set a text to. So Joy to the World, not as old as some of the things we've sung, and certainly a piece of music that you certainly know about. What do you know about Handel? Just as we're passing by, we said there are a few musicians we need to stop and talk about for a few minutes. Where was he from? What do you know about Handel? What year? Well, you've got a hint about his years. He was actually born in Germany, but there came a point where, as in those days, it was not unusual for a musician to travel to a nearby village, a nearby country. Sometime, if you were really lucky and you were had a patron who paid for your travel, you might get to go further away. He happened to live in a family for whom money was not a problem, and he went to England. He fell in love with the place. He came back to his appointment in Germany for a few years, but eventually went back to England, took out English citizenship, and stayed there. And so when we think about his later writing, it's always as Handel, the Englishman. He was very clever as far as being able to write for whatever the area demanded. At the beginning of his career, the opera was just coming into play, and he was very astute at being able to write good opera. So he wrote many operas. Just after that, the same kind of thing that's going on in the church then attracted his attention. An oratorio, for which Messiah is actually the church's version of an opera. It's where you sing the text instead of having a play with the people speaking the text. So he takes the idea of how to write opera and takes that into a religious text setting and does oratorios. What are some of the others that he wrote that tell the religious story? They're not nearly so popular as these, but if you're really into Handel, you'll look up Israel in Egypt, or you'll look up Saul. After that, the idea of opera began to be not so popular anymore, and he was so talented that he was able to change. He wrote instrumental music, harpsichord music, organ music, secular music, sacred choral music. So much of what we play as organists are his wonderful organ concerti. And it's just a great attribute of his marvelous talent that he was able to sort of go with the times. When the opera was in, he was talented enough to do that and was able to change as the time went on. That's why he's left us this beautiful collection of music from many, many different styles. He wasn't just a single person writer. He didn't just do organ music, or he didn't just write choral music. So there's more than you probably want to know about Joy to the World, but Joy to the World with all of its music taken right out of Messiah. What are some others? You're probably saying, well, don't we have anything here from this year? What happened in these past few years? Let's look at 641 for a moment. That's in your blue book. I wanted to talk to you a bit about 641, not because I want us to sing it. It's a bit difficult to sing. But here is a beautiful text writing. Vida, a wonderful Polish writer, still living and still writing in America today, wrote this for a bishop and a Lutheran bishop who happens to live on the East Coast. Vida heard him preach this marvelous Christmas sermon one year that talked about Jesus coming and about the incarnation rather than, quote, all the fluffy stuff of Christmas. And he was so taken with it that he wrote this beautiful Christmas text based on what Bishop Snyder's sermon had said. Now, if you look there, you see his name listed as the text writer. And then he was purely a text writer and needed someone to write the music. So you look there, and he went to one of our most extraordinary writers of the last century, Paul Mons. Many of you probably have seen him, heard him, particularly all the Minnesota people who live where he's worked for so long, and you're lucky to be able to live there and see him and hear him. In the early times, he was at Mount Olive in Minneapolis for like 30 years, and while there, he served at Concordia Lutheran in St. Paul as the head of their music department. He later, for 20 years, was also on the faculty at the seminary in Chicago, and in most recent years was the cantor musician at St. Luke's Church in Chicago. Now, he wrote prolifically. He's still living, although in recent times he's had some very serious health problems. But Paul Mons, one of our great, great Lutheran hymn writers, music writers, and particularly in the organ fields, you've heard him play. He's probably one of the great masters of improvisation. If you ever get a chance or even to get a recording of his hymn festivals, what he can do with a piece of music to make it live for you is just extraordinary. So I thought this was a good example of a piece that has beautiful text written to the music written by one of our great Lutheran hymn writers. Think about this text. Peace came to earth at last that chosen night when angels clothed the sky with song and light. And God embodied love and sheathed his might. Who could but gasp, Emmanuel? Who could but sing, Emmanuel? And the text goes on, how else could I have known you? How else could I embrace you? Who could but pray, Emmanuel? Who could but praise, Emmanuel? It's beautiful text writing that takes some of the figures of Christmas and puts them to this wonderful piece of music. I'll be glad to play the piece for you. I think it's hard for us to sing at one time through. Spending some time on and learning, and it's an idea of contemporary music set for a Christmas text. What about 51 in your green book? Now here you look down at the bottom of the page and you see a familiar name for us. Oh, Martin Luther, I think I've heard of him. 1500. You know, sometimes I think it probably gets a bad time because it has 14 verses. And so often we may not sit down and sing it. Do you know why he wrote this? Anybody hazard a guess about why Martin Luther wrote it?
For his children?
He did. He wrote it for his family singing around the Christmas tree on Christmas Eve. So he never intended that... it's not to say we shouldn't sing it, we certainly should, but his intention was around his own family gathering. Now think about that. How might that have worked? You know, they could have sung two verses and maybe they had some Christmas cookies or whatever one did. I suppose in earlier times this week I should have been mentioning Ludifus, but I just don't think Martin Luther did that. But think about this wonderful text that Martin Luther wrote. And it really gives so many symbols of the Christ child. From heaven above to earth I come to bring good news to everyone. And verse 12, O dearest Jesus, holy child, prepare a bed soft, undefiled, a holy shrine within my heart that you and I need never part. Think about how he may have used this. He was such a great teacher. And I can just imagine that he sat around with his children, singing a verse, talking about what it meant. I don't know that he did this, but I think that my imagination supposes that this might be. Now look at the hymn tune Name, that's on the right side there at the bottom, and how is that related to this piece of music?
German.
It's German, and it pretty well just says that text again, doesn't it? From heaven above. Actually, the tune for this in the early times, he picked up a tune that was a folk tune. They had a little game that they played in those days called the Garland Game. And if They would sing the tune, and just imagine this. The words went, good news from far abroad I bring, good tidings for you all I sing. I bring so much you'd like to know, much more than I shall tell you, though. So you can imagine the Garland game. So they would all be in a circle, and the young man would sing to the young woman a riddle, much more than I care to tell you. He would tell her a riddle. If she could answer the riddle, then she had to give him the garland that she wore in her hair. And this is a game that was played. It's still a wonderful melody, and Martin Luther, you can imagine, is hearing this melody everywhere that he goes, or he certainly knows about the game from his family. So he takes a common secular song that's used in a children's game and uses it with this wonderful Easter, a Christmas text. How many of you use that in your parishes? You don't have to be Lutheran to use this. It's probably everywhere. I'm pretty sure that from a musician's point of view, the reason we often don't use it is because we look at those verses and think, oh my, how do I choose the best out of this? And maybe sometime we just have to sit down and sing it and use it for all of our verses for a whole service, and that way it doesn't seem to be so much. Now, we said that Easter, why am I doing that? Pardon me, this is Christmas, I know better than that. We said that Christmas was not the earliest part, that the oldest festival really was Epiphany. The church was celebrating Epiphany before they were doing Easter. This came in both the Eastern and the Western churches as they celebrated the idea of three kings, or the sages, or the wise persons coming from some faraway land. One wonderful thing that the Blue Book has done for us is to bring back that it was not in our former book, but if you look at 646, you'll find it now. I think one interesting thing for this is the wonderful imagery that we talked about, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And as a child, at least, it would give us a hint as to what those were. I knew there were things that the wise men brought, but I sure had no clue as to what they were about. At least gold, I could figure out what that was, but frankincense and incense, oh, this makes some sense, or myrrh, a perfume. So you have, you know, the tradition often shows the three wise men. We probably don't know if there were three or two or 30. But in much of our singing, we talk about the three kings of Orient. Now, if you look at the text and the tune, this is something we haven't seen yet today, and that is where the text and the tune were both composed by the same person. In the 1800s, this is an American composer. He was a leader in the Episcopal Church and wrote many hymn tunes and text. And so this comes to us out of the 1800s, and it's back where we can find it in our blue books now. Let me make an aside here. I said earlier, this class doesn't suppose you're Lutheran. We all have hymn books, and I'm pretty sure that many of these are in your hymnal, whatever that is. The reason I'm using green and blue here is because those were the hymn books that I knew were available here, and it's a little bit of a trek to bring a large collection of hymn books through 20 people as we come up on the boat. So just assume that what we say about the hymns in this book are no different than most of the hymns that will be in your own hymnals. We talked about one of the themes as we dashed through the church here yesterday, about one of the themes of Epiphany being light, and how the whole season of Epiphany, we talk about ways that Jesus was manifest to the people. That's a pretty big word, but for all of us, we just know that that means that whole season we're looking at scripture text and singing songs that talk to us about how Jesus was made known to the people. I always wish that January 6th could go on longer, because we have the festival of the Epiphany, but in many of our churches, because that is a festival on a specific date, And if you don't happen to have Sunday on January the 6th, very often we're already to the baptism of Jesus by the first Sunday that we get to after the 6th of January. So we don't often get to celebrate it in the fullness that it is. Even though we have a whole season of Epiphany, it often goes on to other points about Jesus. How long is Epiphany? We said Advent is very orderly. We know it's four Sundays, period. It doesn't change with the season, and that's mostly because it's fixed on Christmas, which is fixed on a date. So we can count back four weeks, and that's always the same. How long does Epiphany go?
3 to 7.
What is it tied to?
Easter.
Yes, and Easter varies, doesn't it? So you may have four Sundays after Epiphany, you may have seven Sundays, and it all depends on where it comes, where Easter comes, and that backs up to help us count how many Sundays we'll have in Epiphany. We talk about the three kings in Epiphany. We talk about light, lots of things about light. But that very first Sunday after Epiphany, we're already talking about Jesus' baptism. Now, I wanted you to look at 647. When you start trying to look for baptismal hymns, it's sometimes hard to find them. We have a lot of baptism music hymns, but they're often things that are written to talk about our children's baptisms or our own baptisms, not so much Jesus' baptism. Now, this hymn was actually written because there was a desire to have a piece of music that could be used on the Sunday that we have the text about Jesus' baptism. A name you should know, Fred Pratt Green, wrote this text. He was commissioned to write it. And you look at the text about Jesus coming to Jordan to be baptized by John. Then Fred Pratt Green takes that same idea of Jesus' baptism and then uses the third verse to implore the same thing. Come, Holy Spirit, aid us to keep the vows we made. Fred Pratt Green was a prolific writer. He is dead now, but not for so long. And it, too, is set to an English folk tune. But this time it was adapted by another great English person of this past century's fame, Ralph Vaughan Williams. And you probably know more of his things. We'll come to some more of his pieces. But this particular piece of music was actually commissioned to be used for that first Sunday after Epiphany. We talked about songs of thankfulness and praise, and manifest, if you look just real briefly, look at this. If you take a quick look at number 90 in your green book, Christopher Wordsworth, you see the text writer. He's a nephew of another famous poet. Who do you suppose that was? William Wordsworth. You probably remember reading his work in your English days. His nephew wrote this, and what I wanted to point out particularly, we talk about Epiphany and manifest, and here this has all this wonderful imagery of the whole Epiphany season, manifested by the star to the sages, manifested at Jordan stream, Jesus' baptism, and at Cana's wedding guests. These are all texts that come up during that Epiphany season. Manifested, anthem, changing water into wine, Jesus' miracle at the wedding feast. So then every one of these verses ends with that little phrase, God in flesh made manifest. So a wonderful Epiphany hymn. Now we go at this a bit backwards because the season of Advent was much younger than the season of Epiphany. We said that Epiphany is almost as old in its celebration as Easter. Next, after Epiphany, we know that by the 4th century, the Christian communities were celebrating Christmas. And then we know that Advent, at least in Spain, was already being mentioned in the 400s. So that's something that has come to us much more recently than the other feast. By the 5th century, it was a 40-day season of preparation that was being practiced. And so eventually, Rome adopted the idea of the 4 weeks leading up as an Advent season. But that's by the 5th century, so that's much more recent than saying that the Christians from the earliest time celebrated Easter. We talked yesterday about a beautiful Advent hymn that if we wanted to ask, perhaps a common Advent hymn is O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. That's on 34 in the Green Book. I pointed out yesterday that this text writer was patterning this after a choral piece of the time called the Great O Antiphons. Now, an antiphon is the sung response, and the O simply refers to all these wonderful images that we talked about, these Advent images. Look at all the ways that Jesus is described. O, and you help me out. What were some of them? O Emmanuel. O
Great Lord.
Great Lord. O Branch of Jesse. O Dayspring. O Key of David. There was actually a piece of music, the Great O Antiphons, that expanded on all of this, but the text writer took this and put them all into one text here, into something smaller that a congregation might sing. We said that most of our hymnody comes to us in some other language, and so for us to be able to use it, we have to have a translator. And we will see John Neal's name in many, many places as a translator of music in the 1800s. The tune we know, well, we do know, but what I find fascinating is we've thought over the centuries that that was probably a French processional. But it's only in the last 20 years that a document's been found that actually had this written down as the French processional of the 15th century. You know, a lot of times we're assuming, or we think, or this seems like it probably was. But in the last 20 years, a document was actually found in France that showed this as a French processional. What's the name of this hymn tune? Here again, it sort of emphasizes the name of this tune again. Now, here's a good place to talk about those funny numbers. We said 8888888 is a metric interpretation. And what's metric? It's really just the, I don't want to say beat, but it's the pulse of the text. And the first phrase is going to have eight little things to it. Listen to this. O come, Emmanuel. Eight. And the next one. And ransom captive Israel. So if you look down at the numbers at the end of any of these, it's simply underlining for you what the metric measurement of this piece is. Now, why do you want to know that? I can't really tell you why we have the metric index, but I do know one way it can be used. Now, sometimes my pastor will say, I've got to have this text for my hymn after the sermon or before the sermon. This is the text that talks all about my sermon, and I must have it. I, as the musician, look at it and think, oh my, we've never seen this text, and I know we've never seen this hymn. This is pretty deadly. So one way I might be able to do it is to say, well, maybe there's another hymn tune we could sing this to, a tune that we already know, and that way we only have to worry about a new text. Now, you can have fun doing this, but you have to remember that tune and text somehow must have some relationship to each other. You don't want to put a slow, meditative text to a great march of onward Christian soldiers, and you can fill in the rest of those blanks. Now, just for example, though, let's look at O Come Emmanuel, and if you look at Melita, which is the hymn tune, you don't have to look it up for My Hope is Built on Nothing Less, or the Navy hymn, bum, 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 bum. If you look at that, it has that 8888888 meter also. You know how it sounds. Now, I would not suggest that you swap these two out, but it would work. Oh, come, oh, come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel. And it works. That's just to take two familiar pieces and say, you probably wouldn't put O Come, O Come, Emmanuel with that, mostly because our brains are already saying Navy Hymn or My Hope is Built on Nothing Less. It's too familiar to really swap those out. They don't work. But you can use that. So some Sunday when you get to church 45 minutes early, grab yourself a book and look in the back at the metrical index and just look at some of the ways that hymns might be interchangeable. Now, I thought you might like to look at a hymn tune that's come to us for Advent in the Blue Book, 626. People Look East. What do you think this is about? Well, it's certainly part of it. I suppose that if you think about where the wise men were coming from or any of the things like that, people are, the East may be referring to the prayer time. Look east, the time is near for the crowning of the year. Make your house fair as you're able, clean the hearth and set the table. And then for every one of the verses, it ends in a way that might be useful if we were going to use this for a lighting of the Advent wreath. Love the guest is on the way. Love the rose is on the way. Love the star is on the way. Love the Lord is on the way. This was written, and once again, a French carol. And you know this carol, perhaps. Just look at the text. Further back than that, that we might look at would be number 28 in your green book. Who wrote this? If you look, this is almost as old as the hymn tune we talked about yesterday, being one of the oldest hymn tunes in the book. What Christmas hymn is probably the oldest hymn text in the book? If you were here yesterday, give me either a hymn number or the name of it, or something about it. Either the kind of tune it was set to or a text. Probably the oldest hymn in the hymn book.
Of the Father's Love Begotten.
And because you remembered so well, you've heard today, if you were in the Bible study, you've heard references to the Holden Prayer. This has always been a very special prayer to me, and I never realized how beautifully it was connected with Holden. You'll find these in the bookstore, but this is an artistic arrangement of that. I think that the source for that prayer, if you're at home trying to remember this wonderful prayer, yeah, I think if you'll look in the Matin service in the green book, you'll find it there. So take a look at that prayer. I think you'll hear it several more times this week. It's the one about where we're sitting, we don't know the ending to. So that was out of the hymn text of "Of the Father's Love Begotten," we said was the earliest hymn tune, the earliest hymn text in the book. But this one comes very close too. St. Ambrose in the 300s, but toward the end of that century. It was then picked up, the hymn tune, by Bach, and if you play any of Bach's works or know many of his cantatas, you know that this tune appears in many of them. Some of the beautiful poetry in this hymn. Wondrous birth, wondrous child, mighty God and man in one, eager now his race to run. How about number 5 verse? He leaves heaven to return, traveling where dull hellfires burn, riding out, returning home as the Savior who has come. Now, if you look at the hymn tune name, that too is just a repetition of the name that's up at the top of the book. And you could find ways that you could use this if you could find another hymn tune and you didn't know that. So what we've said is that through this beautiful season, we're able to celebrate all these wonderful ideas about Christ as the Christ child coming, that wonderful time that we lead up to that, and the time afterwards. You hear so many people say, well, boy, we've really messed up Christmas with all this secular stuff. But what are some of the ways that both the secular world and the Christian world sort of illuminate each other as our Christmas celebrations? Tell me some of the things that are familiar to you that we have brought in from the outside secular world that add to our Christmas celebration.
The Advent candles?
The Advent candles certainly are a good example of that. But think about Christmas. What are some things with Christmas?
Presents.
Presents, I like that. What about, even the Christmas tree for that matter. What about food? Is food a part of your celebration of Christmas? Some of you were telling me, we have to come back to Ludifus for that, don't we? People were telling me last week about the ways that they celebrated Christmas and how much it's wrapped up with food and the traditions that go with your Christmas Eve or your Christmas Day dinner. And even though this is the secular world, it all goes together to add to our observance of Christmas. What are some other things?
Caroling.
Pardon?
Caroling.
Caroling, certainly. And that's sort of a combination of both, isn't it? Where we can sing our faith and sing the songs that we've learned through the church. Other ideas of how these two days come together, how these two cultures come together to kind of help each other in the celebration of Christmas.
Feeling of goodwill.
Yes. Well, I want to just, I want you to look for one last new hymn that you may or may not know, and that would be number 636. Once again, our Polish friend who's living in the United States writing, Carl Vita, and then another Lutheran hymn tune writer, Carl Schalk, who is still alive and writing wonderful music. This first appeared as a choir anthem, and so you were only able to hear it as your choir sang it, and maybe they would print the text out for you. But it now comes to us in this book that we can look at and see the wonderful text that we have. Do you know this? Let me play it for you. Thank you.
If you don't know the tune, hum along. But on this day, the 11th of September, it has a text that isn't just about Christmas. The love that we have always known, our constant joy and endless light, now to the loveless world be shown, now break upon its deathly night. Into one song compress the love that rules our universe above. Sing love, sing love, sing God is love. Sing love, sing God is love. Have a good rest of the day. We have a few minutes to get to dinner. Tomorrow's session will be an expansion of the Easter season. And you'll know we'll start with Easter. We'll back up and see how we got to the Lenten celebrations that we Lutherans seem to love to dwell in. And we'll make a case that maybe we really would be better off to spend all our time, spending more time in the Easter season after to Pentecost. So come back tomorrow. We'll tell you tomorrow about a Bible study we had last week where our leader said, if a person's only going to choose 2 days out of the year to come to church, and it's just Christmas and Easter, he made the point that he would rather suggest to people they should come Good Friday and Easter, because you can't celebrate Good Easter with the joy that it needs if you haven't been through the Good Friday experience. If you have time tomorrow, please come again. If not, I've really enjoyed talking with you today and sharing with you the great hymns of the faith.
Thank you.
Thank you.